National Council of Jewish Women, February 12, 1982. Dana Eggert and Rhea Lehman interviewing John Robin. Continuing.
Mr. Robin, we concluded our last interview discussing your role as Executive Director of the Urban Redevelopment Authority in Pittsburgh from 48 to 54, and in particular the Gateway Center project. What were other specific accomplishments of the Renaissance?
Well, the Redevelopment Authority at that time was a new institution, and while the Gateway Center project was its most dramatic and most successful enterprise, it also at that same time carried out a redevelopment project on the south side of Pittsburgh for the expansion of the Jones and Laughlin steelmaking facilities there, and cleared a block in Oakland for the erection of the Graduate School of Public Health, which of course stands at that place today. The authority also laid the plans at that time during my administration for the renewal, reclearance, and redevelopment of the Lower Hill area, which led to the erection of the Civic Arena, which is still there, sitting, being Renaissance tuned presently, and the other developments that have occurred in that area. And subsequently, after I left Pittsburgh, a very large program touching many parts of the city was put in progress, including the Allegheny Center on the north side, the redevelopment of the East Liberty Business District, which is probably the least successful of our programs. But the Redevelopment Authority was not the only instrument of Renaissance II, Renaissance I. You also had the smoke control program, which was probably the most significant thing, underlying thing, was done in toto. And the flood control program, which rescued much of downtown Pittsburgh and the low-lying areas of the north side from floods, creating an opportunity for redevelopment. The institution of the Public Parking Authority, very considerable expansion and improvement in the city's park system and recreational systems. The founding of the Allegheny County Sanitary Authority, which has cleansed the rivers. The erection of Three Rivers Stadium, very conspicuously Mellon Square in downtown Pittsburgh, and so on and on. So it was a very vibrant period of public and private activity, and continued, I would think, from 1946, really, well into the 1960s.
May I ask, how many of the major corporations, Pittsburgh is really a hub of major corporations, were here before smoke control, or did smoke control really then, was that instrumental in attracting?
I would think no. I don't think any major new corporations came to Pittsburgh during this period. Many that were here stayed. That was the major thing. In other words, there's always a temptation, an opportunity, of course, to move. And there's a draw to places like New York then and now to the West Coast for major corporations if they're unhappy with their present location. You may have seen in the New York Times a day or two ago that Harcourt Brace Jovanovich, the publishing company, has decided to leave New York and go to Florida or California. Our major accomplishment, I think, was anchoring in Pittsburgh the major corporations which were here for historic reasons primarily, and making them comfortable in the Pittsburgh environment. And to the best of my knowledge, no major company has left Pittsburgh in all these 30-odd years, and I think it's largely attributable to the improvements in the environment and the cooperation and expansion the city government provided, and as well as a opportunity to enlist the actual interest of corporate leadership in the city. You know, I think the whole idea of the Allegheny Conference and the Renaissance program gave many business leaders a sense of participation. And when you participate, you tend to accumulate pride and commitment. And I think that also took place and is still taking place.
That's an impressive list of accomplishments, I would say.
Well, I honestly believe that what was done here in the first Renaissance period had a major effect in saving Pittsburgh from becoming a branch town. In a sense, a perhaps a very dangerously exposed town economically. Because if we had lost the corporate headquarters and then went into a period, which we did, of industrial obsolescence in much of the surrounding area, and changing technologies and changing economies, we could have become a major Camden or Gary, Indiana. And I think Youngstown indeed. So I think the major achievement is to have stabilized the economy of the city and to set in progress a steady improvement in its environment.
From some of my reading, I know that you're credited along with Gilbert Love with writing up much of the research for the Renaissance on smoke control. Did this research lay the groundwork, or did it give impetus to the program?
Well, actually, what Gilbert and I did was to write the report of the mayor's commission on smoke control. And this actually occurred in the Scully administration.
I see.
And I was then the mayor's secretary, and acted, I think, as secretary of the commission as well. And the impetus for the smoke control program largely came from three individuals in Pittsburgh. Edward T. Leach, who was the editor of the Pittsburgh Press, and Dr. I Hope Alexander, who was the city's director of health, and Councilman A.L. Wolf, who became the great champion of the necessary legislation. The press published a series on what had been done in St. Louis, which was really the pioneer city in the post-war period in attacking smoke, dense urban smoke, I guess you could call it. And St. Louis was much like Pittsburgh because it depended upon soft coal, bituminous coal, as its principal residential and commercial heating element. And what they did in St. Louis was reach a radical conclusion that they can never control smoke unless they control its source. And the source obviously was principally the soft coal which was being burned. And they enacted legislation which in effect made it illegal to burn soft coal unless you had a mechanical device which automatically fired it, so you got a smokeless fire source of heat and no emissions. And the Pittsburgh program was frankly modeled on the St. Louis program. And so the research that was necessary was how did the St. Louis ordinance come to be? How did it work? How had it been accepted? And what alternate sources of fuel did we have in Pittsburgh to substitute for soft coal? That was enacted into legislation in 1941 with a phased period in which it could be achieved. And then it was obviously postponed because of the outbreak of World War II. And so then it became an issue when Mayor Lawrence took office in 1946. Was he going to revive the ordinance and accept a new set of dates? And what was done was yes. That's what we did. And there was a political risk on the mayor's part, and he knew that, because many people found it very inconvenient, obviously, and expensive to change your heating. You have to be an old Pittsburgher to remember the days when there was a load of coal delivered in front of the house, and somebody had to shovel it down into the through a cellar door into the basement. You had to get down and fire the furnace. That's the way we had lived here for 100 years or more. And there was a shortage of available smokeless fuel. So there was a real somewhat crisis atmosphere of how this could all be put into effect. But the mayor stood very solidly by the program, as did the majority of council. And a number of helpful things happened. first, which were not foreseen, but which were very fortunate. One, the railroads found that they were better off to convert to diesel than to burn soft coal. So you had the elimination of railroad smoke, which was, in the old Pittsburgh, was one of the most conspicuous things you could see, because as the trains moved through the city, you could see the plume of smoke moving through the city behind them. It was very dense smoke. Also, natural gas became competitive with coal, and it's an extremely clean and convenient fuel. And so you had a transition, really painless transition, from coal-fired furnaces, space heaters, to natural gas. And that really overcame the difficulties of the enforcement of the ordinance. And there was a noticeable, remarkably noticeable, change in the atmosphere of the city. And so that, in the end, both Mayor Lawrence and the Renaissance program profited by what had been a risky operation.
As well as the city of Pittsburgh.
As well as the city of Pittsburgh, of course. So that's really the story of that one. I think Mayor Scully should get a good deal of credit for that, too, because, as I say, it was done in his administration. He appointed the commission that framed legislation. And so he was also enthusiastically supportive of the program. But I've always felt that essentially Ed Beach and Alexander and Abe Wolk were the triumvirate that led us into it.
In 1955, you became Secretary of Commerce for Pennsylvania. Was this assignment concurrent with your responsibilities for Renaissance?
No, I had to resign from my Pittsburgh job, joined the governor's cabinet in Harrisburg in that assignment. And the purpose of that was to see, I think, whether the much advertised Pittsburgh analogy could be effective on a state basis. And that's why I think the governor wanted me to join with it. I didn't stay in Harrisburg very long. I stayed there less than a year.
I see.
For a number of reasons. I didn't like the atmosphere of the city, or the, not so much of the city as of the legislature and the way in which government is conducted, was then conducted in the state. And after putting forth a program, much of which was actually enacted and modified and improved, I felt that my responsibilities had been accomplished. And the program that we put in at that time developed into what became known as the Pennsylvania Industrial Authority, PIDA, which makes low-interest loans for industrial and economic development, which is still in place. And I continued, however, to be closely related to the state administration, and I served as chairman of the State Planning Board, which was an unpaid office, after my return to Pittsburgh and into the Lawrence administration. I came back to Pittsburgh primarily, too, to become the head of an organization known as the Regional Industrial Development Corporation, RIDC, which again is still in existence. And I was its founding president. Its theory was to solicit the support of the existing Pittsburgh regional economic forces to come behind an effort to bring more and to maintain the economy. I never felt that I accomplished very much at RIDC. My heart really is in urban development and not in industrial development. I can understand it and sympathize with it before it, but I don't get the same enthusiasm from it, because I figure somebody else could do that, and it will happen anyhow. And at any rate, after being at RIDC for 2 years, I was then asked to go to Philadelphia to become the executive vice president of something which they called the Old Philadelphia Development Corporation, which was more in my direct line of interest, and because it was project oriented within a city. Also, they offered to double my salary, which is always an attractive incentive. And third, because at that time I thought to myself, should I not try to test whatever ability I had against another environment rather than the Pittsburgh environment? In other words, say that I've been able to help in a number of things here. Could I do the same thing in another place? And that was tempting to test, to find out whether you could or not, because I could argue with myself, well, you had unusual advantages at Pittsburgh. You were in the mayor's office. You grew up there. You knew everybody. It was easy. Were these circumstances likely to change in another city? And Philadelphia was not so far away that I would lose contact with Pittsburgh, being in the same state, a few hours away, by cab. So I shocked, I think, Mayor Lawrence and a number of other people by saying, yeah, I'm going down. So I took the job in Philadelphia and stayed there for 6 years. The old Philadelphia Development Corporation was, again, one of these emerging nonprofit, privately supported organizations with business interests commanding them, concerned with the redevelopment and improvement of the city. In Philadelphia, my responsibilities weren't citywide, however, they were in the old or central, what they call Philadelphia Center City, which means the downtown area, the area surrounding it. And there we, in cooperation with the city government, we were very successful because we created a program known as the Society Hill Renewal Area, which is probably the most, now 20 years or more later, very stable and consistently improving area in central Philadelphia, which has expanded and overflowed its original boundaries. And I've taken very considerable pride in having been there to get this set up and to stay 6 years to see it through. We also promoted the Independence Mall developments. And I feel that my years in Philadelphia were very fruitful. And the reason they wanted me to come is they wanted to somewhat duplicate, they thought I could help duplicate what Pittsburgh accomplished. And I found a very congenial mayor, Mayor Dilworth, whom I knew in office, had a very excellent board of directors, including the president of the largest bank, and a man in his vice president who became a very close friend, Gustav Amsterdam, who was with the Greenfield companies. So altogether, I found it very pleasant. And I can now go back to Philadelphia, look around and say, well, I helped do this, which is a very nice feeling.
Yeah, sure it is.
And that was the Philadelphia experience, primarily.
That was mostly residential experience.
Mostly residential and commercial, but it was a mix. You're quite right. The idea was to restore the old houses and the atmosphere of old Philadelphia. Philadelphia, unlike Pittsburgh, obviously was settled 100 years earlier and had many brick houses in the colonial and federal period, which had a great charm, really, in the older part of it, which had been blighted by commercial intrusions and by dilapidation. And we were able to just change the whole character of the place and make it the most desirable place in Philadelphia for people who want an urban existence. I'm only sorry now that I didn't buy the property.
Hindsight.
Well, I suppose I had a reluctance. I don't think anybody who was in this kind of work ought to invest in his own. I mean, you begin to get a conflict of interest morally, I think. So, at any rate, I've been very wise. However, I should have suppressed my scruples, and I wouldn't be sitting talking to you. I'd be in Nairobi.
Were you, did you move to Philadelphia for this?
Yes, we moved to Philadelphia, and my daughter went to University of Pennsylvania. My son continued at the University of Pittsburgh.
I see. Would you clarify a term for me, Mr. Robin? Through your beat repeatedly, the term state planning is used. What exactly does that mean?
Well, that's a good question. Officially, there is an organization for some years in force called the State Planning Board. And its attempt to do, and it's done it with various degrees of success, to do for the state of Pennsylvania what a city planning commission does, primarily for a city. To prepare a capital budget, to look at basic economic and environmental problems before they become acute, and to advise the governor and the legislature on forward steps and looking rationally, really, at the state's problems and trying to outline a program by which those problems can be countered. And the State Planning Board, as I say, has never been as strong as a city planning agency because it doesn't have the authority that the law gives a city planning body on the whole. And there is no such thing as statewide zoning or statewide land use planning. but essentially it's a desert job. It's advisory, and it should be catalytic. It should try to think ahead and propose programs which will have a generally beneficial effect, and particularly to try to develop a capital program so that you don't have new starts or old starts or false starts or delays in everything that you attempt to do. And it hasn't succeeded brilliantly in the state, but I'm sure there's various evolutions. The state's better off having it. The one thing that I did while I had that job, and somewhat subsequently in Philadelphia, while I was in Philadelphia, which was of an interstate nature, which I've always considered very important, I was a Pennsylvania representative in the group which, together with the states of New York, Delaware, and New Jersey, developed a wholly new concept of river basin management, which we call the Delaware Basin Commission. And that produced a compact, which is a word of art, it's really the equivalent of an interstate treaty, between the four states and to which the federal government joined, on how to regulate the flow of water in the Delaware, how to manage a resource which is essential both to New York and to Philadelphia. And we got that enacted into law and continues to function. I've been fortunate enough often to be a first. I was the first urban redevelopment director in Pittsburgh. I was the first president of the Regional Industrial Development Corporation of Pittsburgh. I was the first executive vice president of the Old Philadelphia Development Corporation. And I suppose the Delaware Basin Compact is a first. So I always liked that.
That didn't happen by accident.
Well, it's more fun. I mean, you know, you're not bound by your predecessor's commitments to a large degree, and you're starting out. Then when it becomes tiresome, you can leave. So it's always better.
Well, I'm sure those assignments were in recognition of your creativity.
Well, whatever you say, but nevertheless, that's one of the things I like, because you're not bound over by a heavy bureaucratic responsibility. Mm-hmm. Try to avoid jobs that required me to supervise hundreds of thousands of people. Get bound up in the conduct or misconduct of too many others.
David Lawrence was governor from 59 to 63. Were you in pretty continuous association with him during this period, along with your other
staff? Yes, although not as closely as I'd been when he was mayor and I was with him on a daily basis. I continued to be chairman of the State Planning Board during Lawrence's governorship. And I would go to Harrisburg, I suppose, primarily, really, for things that were of concern to Philadelphia, hoping the state would come to our appropriate assistance. And I maintained a personal friendship, a very strong personal friendship with the mayor, with the governor, and with those around him, or some of those around him. Obviously I wasn't at Harrisburg on a daily basis and had little to do with general state administration or general state policy.
Would you grade the governor as well as a governor? Did he do as well as a governor as you think he did as a mayor?
No, I don't think so. I think he did. First place, the governorship of Pennsylvania, Lawrence's time is, until very recently, you were limited to one term. And for the first year or two of his governorship, I think his heart was still at Pittsburgh, and he found it hard to translate his really basic interest from Pittsburgh, where he'd been 13 years as mayor, to the state. And the state is a much more disorganized place than a city government under normal circumstances. You have 210 legislators, 50 state senators, and a relatively very large now budget. And much of the state's job, which people don't realize, is raising revenue for other people. And much of the state's money goes really in disbursements to education, to local school districts, to public assistance, to what are now called entitlement programs. And you don't have much range in those. I think the governor, as Governor Lawrence concentrated first on balancing the state's budget and keeping the state fiscally strong, which he was able to do. Secondly, I think he put through a bitterly contested program to consolidate school districts in Pennsylvania. I think at one time he had as many as 3,000. Every municipality was also a school district. and he fought hard and long for a consolidation of the school districts. And in Allegheny County, for instance, we went down from 129, I guess it was, to 46, which makes us, there's nobody stronger educational units. And he was very strong in highway safety because he had a personal tragedy in his
family. I recall.
Yeah, his two older boys were killed in an automobile accident. And generally, I would say that the Barnes government was a consolidating period. The leader administration, which he followed, had been very innovative and put through a lot of new programs, very activist for government. And I think it was largely his job, more or less, to consolidate what the leader administration had put into place. So you can't go back and say this great particular achievement came about during the Barnes governorship, as you can against his Merrill Lee period.
I've done some research on your career, Mr. Robin, and you're credited with being, and I quote, David Lawrence's top speechwriter, behind-the-scenes idea man, right-hand man, political strategist, helping set the goals of the new administration. Would you comment on this?
Well, the Pittsburgh Sun-Telegraph, which is now no longer published, once did a story about me with an interesting misprint. They called me the mayor's eight-hand man. So by that description, I must have had eight hands. Well, actually, as I said to you earlier, Lawrence and I had a very close personal relationship, close political relationship. And he did depend upon me to write his formal speeches or formal papers. And he did depend upon me very often to coordinate ideas. Generally speaking, I guess you would call it sort of chief of staff or deputy mayor, whatever it might be. And our relationship continued to be an extremely close one until his death, even though I had been separated by 10,000 miles by that time. And as I say, we had obviously an extremely high regard for each other. And I do think that I was able to guide him in areas which had not been within his experience. And to...
Such as?
Well, I'm thinking he had been a professional politician, really, until he became mayor. He'd never been a public administrator. And our job, my job, and the job of others, was to help him make the transition from being a political manager to being a public administrator. And he was able, I think, brilliantly to combine both roles. His political skill helped him to be a better public administrator. And his confidence, I think, in a number of people, some talent and experience, helped him, again, to be successful.
Broader.
Yeah. And one of his great abilities was a continuous growth. He was not a man who ever lived in the past, and he always met his responsibilities as he saw them and knew them. And you could call forth the better side of his nature. I mean, he really could be a very practical politician, but at the same time, he was a realistic idealist, in a sense, being able to make an ideal actually effective.
Did you generalize that most people that have better political skills are better at administrator?
Well, it depends on the job. I think people with high political skills in a democratic country, obviously, can get more done than people who or do not have them. And I guess the most recent illustration of that is the many failures in the Carter administration, which I think you can attribute to a lack of political understanding, both on the part of President Carter and his advisors. They came from a limited background and were not able to adjust to the problems of dealing with the Congress or with leading the American people. And I don't think anybody can create political skills. I mean, they have to be there inherent
in personality.
Yeah. And there's no school for it. And some people just won't accept the problems of compromise or timing. One of the greatest skills in politics, the essential skill, is timing. Franklin Roosevelt was a great master of that. He knew when the time was right